I think that the seizure of the Wise Honest sends a signal that, in particular, the U.S. is serious about the enforcement of sanctions, and particularly under the maximum pressure campaign.
That man was a U.S. investigator of North Korean rogue ships. I'll talk with him in a moment. This is Thursday, May 16th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, President Trump is denying trade talks with China have collapsed and is characterizing the confrontation as a little squabble. Perhaps the hardest hit Americans due to tariffs are farmers. We'll take a deeper look at that, all on VOA Asia. North Korea accused the United States of robbery Tuesday and demanded the immediate return of a cargo ship seized for allegedly violating international sanctions. In a statement in the official Korean Central News Agency, North Korea's foreign ministry warned of unspecified consequences in response to the U.S. seizure of the Wise Honest. KCNA statement claimed the seizure violates the 2018 agreement between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to improve bilateral relations. The United States announced last week that it had seized the ship, which was originally detained in April of last year by Indonesian authorities. U.S. officials say the 17,000-ton vessel, North Korea's second-largest cargo ship, had been used to export North Korean coal in violation of international sanctions. That's the first time U.S. officials had seized a North Korean vessel. We welcome to VOA Asia Neil Watts. He served as the maritime expert on the UN panel of experts for North Korea for 5 years until last year. Neil, welcome. Are there any valid grounds on which Pyongyang can claim that their ship was robbed?
I don't think so. I think the resolutions are quite clear in terms of if you're involved in ship-to-ship transfers or activities prohibited by the resolutions, that your vessel could be subject to seizure by member states. And the resolutions provide for that and give member states a mandate to do so. I think that the seizure of the Wise Honest sends a signal that, in particular, the U.S. is serious about the enforcement of sanctions, and particularly under the maximum pressure campaign. I've been saying for a long time that a lot of vessels that have been identified as carrying out prohibited activity have continued their activities without any recourse, except for the fact that they were named and shamed in panel of experts reports. And I think if there is a tighter control over the movement of these ships, such as impounding them or seizing them, thus far only three countries have done this. The first was, in fact, Mexico with the Muda bomb, which was seized and subsequently sold for scrap. Then the South Koreans have seized at least four vessels that I know of, and they've impounded them, in fact, under the resolutions. And these are still with South Korea. And so this ship seized by the U.S. makes them only the third country to have done so. So many countries are identifying or photographing these vessels that are breaking the sanctions, but thus far only three have done anything about it.
The United Nations can bring up what is wrong, but it cannot do anything as far as seizing a ship is concerned.
No, all the UN can do is through the panel of experts and the 17-18 committee is to alert member states of illicit activity, and it is up to the member states, who are the eyes, ears, and teeth of the United Nations, to take the appropriate action.
How is North Korea getting around these sanctions, for the most part?
It's getting around the sanctions through various means. The primary means right now is through ship-to-ship transfers. Apparently, the Wise Honest was destined to make a transfer to another ship via ship-to-ship transfer nearby Balikpapan in Indonesia. But, of course, this did not happen. So we're not sure which ship it was going to go to. But there's no doubt that Korea is managing to export its coal either through transshipment or by ship-to-ship transfers through complicit companies who are quite aware that it is North Korean coal and are quite aware that it is prohibited by the resolutions.
How does this happen? Are nations complicit or are just companies complicit in this?
My personal view is that I don't think these are nations involved. I think these are the companies looking to make a quick buck, because of course there's always money to be made out of sanctions because of the high risk, high payment phenomena. And I believe this is simply companies exploiting the situation where you get this really good quality North Korean coal at a great price, and therefore you could make good profits, probably a million plus.
I read that while you were on the UN panel, you had boarded some of these Korean ships. What did you find there? Just describe it. What was it like, and what was the crew like, and how did you deal with them?
Well, I've boarded North Korean ships and foreign flag vessels, which were assisting the North Koreans. For the North Korean ships, you'll find that the ship is generally well cared for, although it's in a poor condition. And the ship carries a wealth of information in terms of its previous voyages. I don't want to speak too much in terms of what we had found, but we found a lot of information, not only about that particular voyage, but about other voyages as well. So it's actually like opening a window on the world of tactics and modus operandi of the North Koreans in terms of where they've been, what they've done, what cargo they've carried, and who are the companies that they deal with.
How were you treated when you boarded these ships?
No, we were treated well and with respect. There was no difficulty at all in terms of getting your movement around the ship. But clearly, none of them were speaking to us or anyone else. I think their line is that once they've been caught, not to speak to anybody other than a lawyer.
I've been speaking via Skype with Neil Watts, who served as the maritime expert on the UN panel of experts for North Korea for 5 years until last year, 2018. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now at voanews.com. A UN official has urged Myanmar to grant aid workers predictable, sustained access to Rakhine State, saying lack of aid has cost lives. Bangladeshi police shot dead two suspected Rohingya human traffickers, officials said Wednesday, after rescuing 103 refugees in 2 days about to attempt to boat to Malaysia. The U.S. Coast Guard cutter Berthoff arrives in Manila following its first joint exercise with the Philippines Coast Guard in the South China Sea amid rising tensions in the disputed area. President Trump is denying trade talks with China have collapsed and is characterizing what many are calling a trade war between the two largest economies as a little squabble. This is VOA Asia. We continue now. U.S. President Trump is denying trade talks with China have collapsed. He's characterizing what many are calling a trade war between the world's two largest economies as a little squabble.
We made a deal with China. It was a deal that was a very good deal. It had to be a good deal, otherwise we're not making it, because we've been down so low in trade, and other presidents should have done this a long time ago. We can't just make a good deal, and I told that to President Xi. But we had a deal that was very close, and then they broke it.
Trump on Tuesday defended the tariffs he imposed last week on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports, but he said nothing about Monday's steep stock market plunge after China countered Trump's levies by announcing June 1st tariff increases on $60 billion worth of U.S. exports. The ongoing trade dispute between the U.S. and China is having an impact on most farmers across this country. Their corn and soybean crops are subject to tariffs and increasing competition from other suppliers. As VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports, U.S. farmers aren't just concerned about their bottom lines this year. They're also worried about the long-term consequences of a trade war on the only business many have ever known.
Life on a farm is filled with routine. For Pam Johnson of Floyd, Iowa, hers is now weighed down by tariffs.
First thing I do is make a pot of coffee, go to the computer and look at what grain prices have done overnight, and usually do a gut clutch because they've been going down. They're at 5 months lows.
Johnson and her husband are proud sixth generation farmers. And like many farmers, they're going through some of the harshest economic conditions of their lives.
We're all tightening our belts.
U.S. farmers are facing a potential sixth consecutive year of declining farm income. Prices for corn and soybeans are down, while the cost of producing them is up. With uncertainty over congressional support for a new trade agreement with Canada and Mexico, and the impact of China's retaliatory tariffs on U.S. grain, short-term concern over U.S. trade policy is turning into long-term fear.
Because we hear it may be out to 2025 before we see some of those markets come back to us, if they ever do. What is the damage being done that's irreparable?
Damage her son Ben Johnson may have to deal with when he takes over the family business.
All farms are going to suffer because of this. There's a difference between making it and flourishing.
The Johnsons feel there is a growing disconnect between farmers and the rest of the American workforce, fueled by politicians increasingly hostile to trade policies the agricultural industry depends on.
I think we need as much trade as we can and to be openly trading with as many places as we can. I mean, it's no different than any business. You want as many customers as you can.
I was really disheartened that trade really has become a dirty word in both parties.
Pam Johnson says she didn't vote for President Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential election based on his trade positions. Nothing since has eased her concerns.
Saying that I'm a tariff man and that trade wars are easy to win concerns me. There's still a lot of farmers who still support President Trump. I think there are more seeds of doubt being planted as we look forward into 2019 and no resolution, and the light at the end of the tunnel seems to be getting dimmer about getting these things done.
Politics aside, Johnson admits success for her family business is closely tied to successful U.S. trade policy.
I don't want to see President Trump fail. We all need him to make this work and to make it so that all of us win.
A win, her son says, can't come soon enough.
Honestly, we've kind of already missed the peak soybean export season, so in a way it's already too late. I guess it's never too late, but before now would have been great.
While negotiations continue, the Trump administration says it is actively working on a new financial assistance program to help farmers weather the continuing trade storm. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Floyd, Iowa.
Happening now in Asia, the Taliban captured a district center Wednesday in southern Afghanistan, killing at least 13 government soldiers. The fighting comes as Russia asserts the Taliban is getting stronger and called for increased efforts to reach a negotiated settlement to the 17-year-old war. Stay up to date with VOA. This is VOA Asia. Thank you for being with us. Men predominantly run the media industry in South Asia, and in particular in Pakistan. But in recent years, more and more women are joining the workforce. From covering tough and challenging topics to entertainment and sports beats, women are rising to the occasion and taking risks by being behind microphones and in front of cameras. VOA's Sidra Dar met with three women playing a pivotal role in their journalism society in this report, narrated by Behzad Hamdard.
A bomb blast on November 21, 2012 left reporter Kiran Khan injured, but did not destroy her deep passion for journalism.
My father told me to stop. He told me that I achieved my goal to be a journalist, but it's time to stop. I asked him, "Do you really think your daughter is that weak?" He has never asked me to stop my work after hearing that.
Khan is currently working as a bureau chief, but says she's always been under immense pressure as a professional journalist.
I've always gotten threats, so you have to manage that pressure. Then there is pressure from family of why I'm covering specific beats. And then work pressure. We have to cover stories on time and be accurate. So your passion gets tested when all those pressures hit you at once. But you continue working.
Ikra Beg got into journalism in 2011, hoping to become a political reporter. She currently covers cultural and entertainment stories.
I used to be told to dress a certain way, wear good makeup, be extra presentable, and maybe I would get a job in this field despite having a degree. But I stuck around and didn't give up. I am now on my fourth agency and people continue to like my work.
Khan and Baik have honed their journalistic skills through nearly a decade in the industry. Manya Shakil, on the other hand, is just getting started. She says her goal is to change the perception that women can't be credible journalists.
Women are often seen as women first and then journalists. Unfortunately, we have to start by convincing the masses that women can run around in hot weather and chase stories. Women can stand near a bomb blast and still do a live report, and that women are not weak.
Despite all challenges, the handful of female journalists in Pakistan are doing everything they can to succeed in their country's male-dominated media industry, one story at a time. For Sidra Dar in Karachi, Pakistan, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
Coming up, some classroom help for the Rohingya. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news alert from VOA Asia. The biggest worries among Vietnamese people are food safety, pollution, and corruption, according to a new survey that suggests not enough has been done about these issues since they were raised 2 years ago. Visit VOA Asia Facebook every day for top stories and great features to see and to share. This is VOA Asia. Most of the school-age Rohingya refugees who arrived in Bangladesh with their parents or relatives fleeing a military crackdown in neighboring Myanmar have had little to no education. As Dave Grunebaum reports from Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh, the massive influx of child refugees has prompted aid workers to develop a new curriculum and provide a crash course for new instructors.
At this refugee camp classroom, ethnic Rohingya children are taught the basics of the Myanmar language, also known as Burmese. They also get lessons in math, English, and life skills. 9-year-old Roxana Begum says she wants to become a teacher someday.
I'm happy when I get to learn.
Her teacher, a Rohingya refugee himself, only has a high school education, a common story for many of the new instructors here.
We are quite well aware that these teachers don't have the competencies and the skills to really teach them. This is why we are developing in parallel a program in order to have a comprehensive training systems.
The refugees are not allowed to enroll in Bangladesh schools. As a result, UNICEF and non-government organizations are building more than 2,000 learning centers for students ages 4 to 14. About one-third of the 300,000 child refugees in this age group still do not have access to a learning center, and neither do most refugees who are older than 14. Many of the children currently enrolled at these centers are in class for only 2 hours a day.
Do you think this will be enough to provide what would be an adequate education?
Adequate education, no, but basic education, yes. I would say giving them the basis in terms of literacy, numeracy, life skill, and so.
Cop, son, queen.
Besides the limited access to schooling, educators face other challenges. 65% of the refugees ages 4 to 14 have not even reached the academic level of a first grader, a reality that only heightens the sense of urgency to educate the children.
Everything we're doing in education with the Rohingya refugee children is taking an incremental approach and building little by little the capacities of the teachers, building the temporary learning centers, building a curricula.
There are concerns that there could be a lost generation of Rohingya children who miss out on proper schooling. And this will impact not only their livelihoods as adults, but the productivity of the Rohingya community.
Roxana Begum's father is concerned about the quality of education she's getting.
We cannot see any good future for our children if they don't get the proper education they need.
We cannot afford to have a lost generation of Rohingya children. This is one of the biggest concerns. Why? Because if children are not getting the education they deserve, the quality of education they deserve, then what's going to happen to future generations?
Educators say they're trying to help these children develop the skills they need to become productive adults. They say the future of the Rohingya community depends on it. Dave Grunebaum for VOA News, Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh.
Now a news alert from VOA Asia. Sri Lanka said Wednesday that hardline Buddhist groups were likely to blame for a wave of anti-Muslim riots that swept the island this week in apparent retaliation for Easter bombings by Islamist militants. In the anti-Muslim unrest that started Sunday, mobs reportedly moved through towns in Sri Lanka's northwest, ransacking mosques, burning Korans, and attacking shops with petrol bombs. Now on VOA Asia, in India, as the number of women voters surges in the country's ongoing general election, the gap with men is expected to close. That's making political parties pay more attention to women's issues. Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi.
In an initiative to celebrate and bring out more women voters, India's Election Commission set up pink polling booths. Balloons, roses, and rooms with women polling officers set a festive atmosphere in some Delhi booths. Once outnumbered by men, women voters have nearly closed the gap. Some believe they can make better choices.
Women can run the house. They know better how to run the country also. So they know who is better for them, like who can run better way, in a better way our country.
Some voted for the first time.
I thought that I should choose democracy over dictatorship. So that drew me out, you know, that I should go and vote this time, you know, against some ideologies which I don't believe in. So this was the first time I voted. I'm very happy that I voted.
Women's issues weigh with young voters like this 19-year-old student.
Gender inequality, pay wage gaps, also very important, these two things which are very important, also women's security, you know, women's security, women empowerment.
Women are demanding better development from political parties.
They should build a hospital.
There is no facility in my village. The roads are broken. Sewers are overflowing. Nothing has been done.
They are being wooed with promises of more jobs, safety, crèches, and even free sanitary napkins as they emerge as an electoral constituency. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
The United States will not join an international bid to stamp out violent extremism online, according to the White House, while stressing that Washington backs the initiative's aims. The White House said, while the United States is not currently in a position to join the endorsement, we continue to support the overall goals reflected in the so-called Christchurch Call. The initiative is named after the New Zealand city, where a far-right gunman massacred 51 people at two mosques in March while broadcasting his rage live on Facebook. It's been spearheaded by New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern and France's President Emmanuel Macron. The White House said in a statement the private sector should regulate its content, but also stressed the need to protect free speech.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have recently been able to gain some insight into the creation of Neptune's tiniest moon, Hipparcos, thanks to observations made with the NASA ESA Hubble Space Telescope. Hipparcos, which has a diameter of only 34 kilometers, was discovered in 2013 after scientists analyzed Hubble-captured images of Neptune. The scientists theorize that Hipparcos is actually a fragment of a close neighboring moon, Proteus, after a comet impacted it billions of years ago. Photos taken in 1989 by NASA's Voyager 2 spacecraft show a huge impact crater on Proteus that scientists say is large enough that could have caused the moon to shatter. The tiny moon orbits Neptune at a distance of about 105,000 kilometers and is within only 12,000 kilometers of Proteus. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud, download our podcast, and take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com, and let's hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook and our email, voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes. Have a great day ahead.